Chapter 7. No Mandalorian soldier should have to fight an Aruates war for the price of a day's food. No Mondoad should have to fight at all, except to defend Mondaiyaim, his home, or his family, or because he wants to. We have to stop being the tool of governments that don't care if we live or die, so long as we do their bidding. Kadika, also known as Venku, addressing an informal gathering of clan leaders. Bevin Vassar Farm, near Kaldabe. Fett waited outside the door for a few moments. He could hear the droid whirring as it moved around the bedroom, and Dr. Bellwine's murmuring voice. As soon as the doctor came out, he'd go in and sit with Sintas for a while. After that, he'd start his sessions with Jaina Solo. His day was planned.
Grandmama keeps asking where she is.
Myrta came up behind him and nudged him in the small of his back. She wasn't quite up to taking his hand or hugging him, and he wouldn't have known how to respond to that kind of intimacy or compassion anyway.
We keep telling her, but her short-term memory is shot to Haran.
Early days, Fett said, wondering who we was.
She won't let go of the Heart of Fire.
Did you call her Grandmama?
I thought that would be asking for trouble, Babuir.
Fett heard boots in the passage behind him, slow and careful, like someone was creeping in and trying not to be noticed. Even without his helmet's 360-degree vision, he knew who it was.
Morning, Orade.
Sukui, Mandalore.
Guess Orade. Myrta's new love stopped in his tracks, clutching some wild vormer blooms.
I brought some flowers for Sintas.
She's blind.
Orade gave him a look that said, heartless barv.
She can smell the scent.
It was a nice touch, something Fett hadn't thought about.
He better treat my granddaughter like a princess, too.
Fett turned slowly to give the lad the full benefit of his unspoken warning.
You marrying Myrta, then?
Yes, Mandalore.
You're the only Mondoad on this planet who cowers to me. Don't.
Orade was a typical tough Mondo lad, but in-laws were a lot scarier than Yuuzhan Vong.
1 minute I'm an orphan. The next I've got family coming out of the woodwork like squalls.
Okay, said Orade, spine stiffening. I'm marrying Myrta, and if anyone has to take care of her grandmother long-term, it'll be us.
My grandson-in-law. Fearfek.
Fett assessed him, and thought he'd do. A Mandalorian wedding consisted of 4 short vows and was usually a private ceremony for the couple, not their families. Fett, still thinking in Aruati terms, wondered whether to feel offended that he hadn't been invited, and then realized nobody else would attend either, although there'd be communal drinking and sentimentality afterward. Not a credit would be wasted on fripperies. Mondoade operated on plain, honest pledges and contracts, in love as well as business.
No urge to revert to Kifar culture, then?
He asked Myrta.
I've made my choice, she said.
The door swung open, and Bellwine came out, looking anxious. Fett took him to one side, while Myrta and Orade slipped into the room.
Is she going to get better?
Fett demanded.
The fact that she's alert and mobile is remarkable enough.
Bellwine lowered his voice so that Fett had to strain to hear him, but he seemed indignant that his treatment hadn't been appreciated.
Most cases were in some degree of coma for months. Her Kifar brain chemistry may have offered her some protection from the worst of the carbonite trauma.
Kifar were different. Fett knew that. The ability to detect past events from inanimate objects was proof of that, just like Gotob had done when he'd told Fett far too much about his history with Sintas simply from holding that Heart of Fire stone. He had to be a Kifar, too.
So she might improve.
She might. Carboniting affects neural connections in the brain. That's why your wife can't see and why her memory is affected. Given time, neurons do regenerate. Stimulation helps. Little mental exercises to stimulate her memory. Objects she might remember, like the necklace. Hollow images, that kind of thing.
Ex-wife, Doctor. Ex-wife.
But the weight of responsibility felt the same. Fett had never been very good at thinking for two, unless the other was his father.
You're saying she's brain damaged?
Technically, yes. But therapy...
You said I had a year to live. I'm fine now.
Belwine squirmed visibly.
You found your Kaminoan scientist, then?
I found what I needed.
Fett hadn't had a checkup since the veterinary lab had cleared his blood samples. Physically, he felt fine. He suspected fate had spared him a premature death so he could hang around and have his past catch up with him.
I'm not proud of anything I've done. I'm not ashamed of anything either. I did what I had to do. I'll find Sintas what she needs. If I need you, I'll call you.
Belwine was always good at knowing when he'd been dismissed. Myrta stuck her head out of the doorway, face set in a frown.
Whatever Medrit says, Belwine did a good job, she said. You're so ungrateful. Grandmama could easily have died.
Fett recalled his first lessons in combat, learned at his father's side.
Commit fully to the attack. Don't let up. Don't stop to think.
It was good advice for facing your past, too. He walked in and sat down at the bedside. Sintas was sitting cross-legged on the mattress, turning the Heart of Fire over in her hands as if she was searching.
Who are you?
She asked, turning her face to him.
Don't stop to think. I knew you when we were younger.
What's your name?
Don't stop to think. Don't... Boba. Boba Fett.
He expected the world to come crashing down at that moment. But Sintas just looked blank, as if she was trying to remember something minor, not the man who'd put a huge dent in her life.
I'm Sintas Vel, and you're Boba Fett, and she's...
Myrta took up position on the opposite side of the bed.
I'm Myrta Gev,
she repeated patiently.
Yeah, Myrta. Are you my little girl? I have a daughter.
Fett switched off. He hadn't planned to, but it happened automatically. It was like a thermostat switch that tripped whenever things were in danger of overheating.
Aelin,
he said. How could he know how much she could handle at one time? She forgot it all the next moment anyway.
Your daughter's name was Aelin. She was about 16 last time you saw her.
I have to find her. She'll be wondering where I am.
Myrta fixed Fett with a stare that said, don't even think about it.
Lots of things have happened while you've been in Carbonite.
Myrta took a deep breath.
I'm your granddaughter.
Sintas didn't react for a while. She kept turning the Heart of Fire between her fingers, lips moving silently. Fett wondered if she was reading it and trying to tie up its information with what she was hearing.
Sin was always sharp, analytical, looking for the angle.
He didn't know what always meant, of course. From meeting her to leaving her had been just 3 or 4 years tops. She placed the heart of fire around her neck, one hand still clutching the stone. Orade leaned over and held the flowers in front of her. "These are Vormer blooms," he said. "It's me, Orade. Remember? From yesterday?" Sintas inhaled the scent and just smiled. At least she wasn't distressed now. That was something. Myrta got up and took something from the cupboard, something Fett hadn't seen in a very long time. It was a red oblong canister with a handle on the top. Somewhere, not here, not now, his heart sank, but he didn't let it touch him.
"We found this in Rezodar's effects," Myrta said, opening the lid.
A hologram leapt into life with a faint hum, triggered by the mechanism. Myrta looked up slowly, fixing Fett with an expression that might have been recrimination or a cue to tell Sintas what he could see and she couldn't. Fett couldn't tell which. The hologram showed Sintas holding a baby, all smiles, and Fett standing with one arm around her shoulder.
"I could have said it was Spar standing in for me, doing Shisa's bidding as usual, the idiot. But that's me standing there. I remember the day."
Fett also remembered killing a lot of scumbags to retrieve that hologram for her, long after they parted. He couldn't, wouldn't, remember how he'd felt when the image was recorded.
"What is it?"
Sintas asked, reaching out toward the source of the hum.
"It's an old hologram," Myrta said gently. "It's you and your daughter, I think. My mother and your husband."
Her eyes were fixed on Fett's, back to the cold black stare she had given him when they'd first met. It was as if Aelin's lessons in hating him were all flooding back to her.
"It'll make sense when you can see again."
Sintas half smiled, looking embarrassed.
"I have a husband. What happened to him? How long have I been out of it? Come on, tell me."
She might have lost her memory, but this was the old Sintas, all right. A no-nonsense bounty hunter who didn't have time for excuses and platitudes. She always wanted to know the score. Fett took a long, slow breath, in the same way he did to prep for storming a room.
"She won't remember tomorrow," Orade mouthed at him.
Fett kicked down the door in his mind.
38 years. Get it over with."
He even looked Sintas straight in the eye, although she couldn't see him.
"And I was your husband. I'm Boba Fett."
He counted to 3, like timing a debt and getting ready to fling himself flat just before the blast wave reached him. But it never came. Sintas's eyes moved from side to side as if she was searching. Her expression was almost beatific as some realization dawned on her.
"Who carbonited me?"
"I don't know. Yet."
"But you found me."
"Yeah."
"You found me."
"We found you."
There was no point giving Sintas the wrong idea. He owed her more than that.
"Myrta did all the work."
"I don't remember," Sintas said. "I don't remember anything. But if you came for me, after all that time, you were still looking.
Fett parted his lips to explain that it wasn't quite like that, but Myrta held up a warning finger. She doesn't need to know that right now. He stopped in his tracks.
You're going to be fine, he said. I'll come back later.
It was a tactical withdrawal. When Fett turned, Bevine was standing in the doorway with his arms folded. He stepped back to let Fett pass, and then followed him down the passage through to the front of the farmhouse, where Dinua and Jintar were having breakfast with their kids in the kitchen, in a world of their own, and clearly delighted to be together again. Fett caught a snatch of their conversation. Jintar was discussing his plans for a new workshop, so he obviously wasn't planning on more mercenary contracts for a while. Some people managed family life effortlessly, even in the most trying conditions.
I could take the Jedi off your hands today, Bevine suggested, unless you want to be elsewhere.
Sooner I kill her idea that I'm some devoted husband, the better, said Fett. Just makes it harder for her when she finally gets the full picture.
He reached the front entrance, but Medrit was blocking it. He was big enough to do that. Medrit had been born solid and tall, but years of pounding metal as an armor smith had added prodigious muscles to his frame.
Wait,
Medrit said imperiously.
No sparring with Jaitise until you're properly dressed.
He crooked a soot-stained finger at Fett and led him to his workshop.
Heads will not roll. Okay?
Laid out on the bench was a set of armor plates, the mid-green paint still unmarked. It was a common color for Mandalorians. It happened to be Fett's color, too.
Might as well make the most of the new Beskar deposits.
Medrit picked up the breastplate and twirled it between his hands.
I said you should ditch that Durasteel armor, didn't I? Here's your proper Beskar gam. Wear it in case the Jedi gets lucky. She'll need to hack away with her JT cod for a week to dent this.
Humor him, Bevine said. He made a collar section specially.
Fett didn't plan on testing the Beskar gam in earnest, but the collar intrigued him. It was a near-circular band that hinged open and protected the neck between the helmet and gorget plate. If his father had worn one, he would probably have survived Mace Windu's decapitating lightsaber blow. Fett slipped it on and rolled his head to test the range of movement in it.
You think I'm going to spend my time fighting Jaina Solo, do you?
Fett submitted to having some plates swapped out.
Plenty more ways to train her to hunt her brother than wearing myself out.
If I had my way, you'd be wearing greaves, too. You ask for trouble, Mandalore.
It doesn't look like mine. Too new.
Okay. You want your dents in it? I'll paint dents on it if you want to look roughy-toughy. It's Beskar. It doesn't dent.
Myrta's reminder that he was an ungrateful Shabuir wormed into his head.
It's good, Medrit. Thanks.
Bevine helped him attach the rest of the plates. The new helmet, he'd sort that later himself. The Durasteel one would do for today. He swung his arms a few times and accustomed himself to the extra weight before replacing his jetpack and Wookiee braids, and then set off for the hangar that he'd earmarked as a training area. Bevine followed him.
You want to watch the show?
Said Fett.
I'm just going to see what skills she's got first.
I don't trust Jedi, Bobica. Not that I don't think you can handle her.
We all trusted Kubariat during the war.
He was a different kind of Jedi. May he find rest in the Manda.
Bevin was a traditionalist. He might not have believed literally in the collective oversoul, but he wished fervently for its existence. He patted the pommel of his Beskad.
But I'll give the woman the benefit of the doubt.
Jaina was waiting for them in the barn, looking very small and dejected as she sat on an upturned pail. She flinched when Fett approached her. He was so used to getting that reaction that he thought nothing of it until he realized the look on her face wasn't alarm, but concern.
"Something wrong?" she asked.
Fett felt naked. She could sense anxiety clinging to him. He was sure that he wasn't letting Sintas get to him, but Jaina seemed to smell trouble anyway.
"Family problems," he said.
"Yeah, tell me about it."
She stood up.
"Your granddaughter?"
There was no reason not to tell her. Everyone in Caldabe knew anyway. The shock might teach her a lesson about not letting anything distract you from the task in hand.
"My ex-wife," he said. "She's just shown up after being carbonited for 38 years. And she doesn't know your brother killed her daughter. Yet."
"If you'd rather be with her now—"
"We've got work to do."
His eyes met Jaina's, and he saw a shared pain he wasn't expecting. Both of them had families torn apart by tragedy. Both had harsh duties ahead. For a heartbeat, they looked at each other, and he could have sworn there was some sympathy, some real compassion in her. He didn't like that at all. Jaina drew her lightsaber with slow caution, as if she didn't want to make anyone too jumpy.
"Want to see what I can do?"
Fett's mind emptied instantly of all superfluous thought. Combat was cleansing. He'd done this so often that it was almost a form of meditation. He was in his natural element again, freed from the alien world of relationships he'd never learned to handle. But he'd learned to master every weapon the galaxy had to offer, bar one.
"Me too,"
said Fett, drawing a lightsaber.
"We can teach each other some new tricks."
Bevin Vassar Farm, outside Caldabe. Jaina had thought that she might start her bizarre apprenticeship with a discussion about Jason's prodigious catalog of force powers, but it wasn't to be.
"I'm no swordsman," Fett said,
holding the lightsaber like a hammer as he circled her. Its blade was green. She wondered whose hand he'd taken it from and how.
"And I've never trained anyone. It'll be an education for both of us."
It had to be a trick. Jaina matched his movements, keeping a constant distance from him. She was aware of Bevin as a deep blue blur to her right, watching, and she didn't feel comfortable. Suspicion emanated from him, but there was a core of, she could only call it, good humor. Maybe he felt this was a joke, but palpable malevolence was missing. She found herself mapping him in her force awareness of the environment anyway. A transponder on a holochart. An enemy vessel not in range, but worthy of cautious monitoring.
"I want to learn what Jason hasn't," she said.
Fett stopped and stood with his head slightly tilted. He looked as if he might be smiling under the helmet, and she was ready for that. She thought he'd taunt her, mock her, generally wind her up to see how fast she lost her temper and how many mistakes she could be provoked into making.
"Tell me what he can do," said Fett, "other than kill unarmed women without touching them.
Jaina felt Bevine move slowly out of her peripheral vision. So Fett didn't want to test her fighting technique. He was distracting her.
Apart from the Academy basics?
Apart from the leaping, mind-influencing, throwing rocks around with his mind.
Telekinesis.
Jaina took a step back to keep Bevine in physical view. He had a blaster and that short, flat saber, both hanging from his belt.
I've known him to move starships, deflect ion cannon, even turbo lasers. He can hear at huge distances with some Theran force-listening technique. He can create elaborate force illusions that feel real. He can walk into the past or future. He can control objects like scanners. And he can mind-rub. He even mind-rubbed Ben.
Made him forget.
Yes.
He could get rich on that.
Fett didn't sound as if he were mocking. In fact, he felt totally neutral to her. A blank slate in the Force. Nothing to read.
Why does he need spies and secret police if he can eavesdrop wherever he wants?
I don't know.
If he can stop turbo lasers single-handed, why does he need a fleet?
Jaina looked for the angle.
Again, no idea.
Why does he need shields on ships when he can create his own?
She was balanced on the balls of her feet now, ready to leap. It was so instinctive, so ingrained by training, that she couldn't override it. She felt threatened. In the corner of her eye, the thin strip of light that marked the barn doors expanded into a wider ribbon, and someone, several someones, came in. She had an audience.
I'm the cabaret. Okay, Fett. I never thought this would be a stroll anyway.
Fett lowered the lightsaber and held it with its tip just above the dusty floor, kicking up little clouds of particles as he walked slowly toward her.
Anything else?
We can't sense him in the Force.
Welcome to the mundane world.
And he can make himself invisible. Sometimes.
Bevine burst out laughing.
Hwahi gar orishukla!
Jaina almost turned, triggered by the simple instinct to face the source of a sudden sound. But she fought it. Fett was totally relaxed, now a couple of meters from her, lightsaber held loosely in one gloved hand. His armor looked different, cleaner, brighter. Maybe he'd put on his holiday best.
"What's that mean, Myrta?"
Fett said. One of the Mandalorians who'd come in was a young woman. Jaina remembered.
"Uh-huh. His granddaughter. The one Mom and Dad met. The one who tried to kill him. I've come to the right place."
Fett understood family rifts. She could feel anxiety in the girl, but it had nothing to do with her. It was more like a bad memory she was trying to forget.
"Bevine says, 'Oh dear, you're totally screwed, Jedi.'"
Myrta moved into her field of view behind Fett, a figure in egg-yolk yellow plates with her helmet under one arm. She felt sharp and bitter now.
"Jason's very clever, isn't he?"
"He killed her mother. Oh, boy."
Jaina felt them all come to a halt. She was tracking multiple targets in her Force sense, aware now of Bevine, Fett, Myrta, and three other armored figures that stood waiting. Maybe she'd made a terrible misjudgment. Maybe they were just going to make her pay for the death of Aelin Vel, an eye for an eye, a daughter for a daughter. Fett was now within striking distance, but his weight was on one leg, not evenly balanced to ready for a blow, and he exuded calm. He was just tormenting her. He shut down the lightsaber blade and studied the intricately carved hilt. Jaina lowered her lightsaber and then shut it off.
"You've got problems, Solo,"
Fett said, hooking his thumb in his belt, weight still on his right leg. Jaina didn't need to be told that.
"How you going to take him, then?"
She had no answer yet. Fett shrugged, and then, the next thing she knew, the wind was knocked out of her as he landed a punch in her gut. Her lightsaber was back on and slashing up across Fett's chest in a split second, unplanned. She snapped straight to instant raw instinct. Fett fell back a couple of steps. Jaina bent almost double, gasping for air as her solar plexus screamed in agonized protest at the punch. But she held her lightsaber out in front of her to ward him off.
"You!"
Nobody had ever jumped her like that before. She hadn't sensed it coming. She struggled for breath. But nobody was mocking her, and she'd expected contemptuous laughter.
"What's that?"
"Lesson over,"
Fett said, inspecting his chest plate. Jaina's eyes were watering, but she could see a scorch mark across Fett from belly to chin. The green paint burned away in a line that spanned the sections of armor like a careless black brushstroke, exposing a streak of bare gray metal beneath.
"Hurts, doesn't it?"
Jaina steadied her breathing with a little help from the Force to settle the disrupted nerve impulses.
"Yes, it hurts, you cretin."
She fought to keep her dignity in front of the audience. News of her gullibility would be all over Caldabe in hours.
"And there's a point to all that,"
she said, determined not to show just how painful the blow had been. Fett still held the lightsaber hilt in his right hand. He'd used it like a knuckle duster, and 70-plus or not, he still had a serious punch on him.
"I hope..."
"There is," he said.
He was still looking down at the lightsaber scar across his plates.
"I'm waiting for you to work it out."
Jaina straightened up and finally decided it was safe to deactivate her lightsaber. If anyone was going to try their luck with her, they'd have done it by now.
"So that's Beskar armor, is it?"
"Beskar Gam," Bevine said behind her. "It means iron skin. We live in our armor. And if the Mandalore hadn't been wearing it, I wouldn't have let him get that close to you."
"If I hadn't been wearing it," said Fett, "I wouldn't have tried."
Bevine, helmet under one arm and a pleasant smile on his face, drew his saber one-handed and held it vertically so that Jaina could look at it.
"If you're willing to spar with me, I'll assess your technique."
"Modest, aren't we?"
Jaina said.
"Does your brother know how you handle a lightsaber?"
"Yes."
"So maybe I can show you how he might use that technique against you."
"Humility, girl. Remember humility." "Of course. Thank you."
The barn was roughly constructed out of timber and duraplast sheeting, pierced by shafts of sunlight from dozens of gaps in the boards. All Jaina could see those gaps as now were sniper positions, vulnerabilities, and she'd never felt exposed like that before. She had strong enough force powers to get herself out of trouble, didn't she? She could deflect blaster bolts. She could leap clear. She could force throw. Fett had psyched her out.
That was it. It had to be.
It was all the family baggage, all the stories she'd grown up with about what he'd done to her father, and how he never stopped, never gave up, how he just kept on coming, and not even the Sarlacc could kill him. But that wasn't going to help her defeat Jason. Now that she could pause to look at her small audience, she found it was a big man in dark gray armor, face obscured by a helmet, a young, blonde, bearded man who seemed to be with Myrta, and another older man with magnificent black matted braids strung with gold clips, his ebony skin marked with raised scars. He gave her a knowing wink. If she'd met him in another context, she would have taken an instant liking to him.
"Don't you get it, Solo?"
Fett asked.
"You played on your propaganda, I think."
"No. I played on your mistakes. You read my body language wrong. You assumed you were safe."
"It's hard to sense danger from you." "Oh, that's clever. You're just confirming how he can kill more Jedi."
She gestured with her thumb at Bevine.
"I was picking up more from our friend here."
"And you still held back."
She pointed to the burn across his plates.
"Hey, I hit you fair and square."
"You assumed too much. You're just training. Nobody wants to hurt you. And nice Mondo is helping you. He's standing all wrong to attack. You want to win? Start out to win. Hit first."
"You're telling me to fight dirty. I get that."
"No. I'm telling you this isn't about lightsaber technique. I'm more than twice your age. No force powers, and I still got you to drop your guard. Winning isn't about being better. It's finding your opponent's weakness and exploiting it."
"So what's Jason's?"
"What's yours?"
Jaina chewed her lip in thought, aware of Myrta's gaze. She looked like more trouble than her grandfather.
"What if I just walked in and laid into Fett? No hello, how are you, anything. Just went for him. Could any of them have stopped me?
The realization dawned on her.
"I use appropriate force, with a small f. I follow the rules of combat."
"Good."
Fett rolled the lightsaber hilt in his palm, and then slid it into the dump pouch on the thigh of his pants.
"You're learning. Next lesson, Goron will show you how to go crazy with a blade."
"But what about Jason's weaknesses?"
"They're yours."
"He's my twin. I know him."
"And he knows you. Be someone else."
Jaina clipped her lightsaber to her belt and understood both the simplicity and enormity of her task. The solution was obvious. It was just very hard to achieve. She didn't need to be fitter or stronger or more skilled. She needed to play it so out of character that Jason wouldn't be able to counter or anticipate her.
"If I could be that different, Fett, I wouldn't be a Jedi."
"There you go,"
said Fett, and walked away. Myrta and the two men without helmets followed him. Bevine stayed. The big guy in dark gray took off his helmet and gave Jaina the kind of look that said she was something he'd wipe off his boots.
"Is this Fett's idea of mystic enlightenment?" she asked.
Bevine shrugged.
"It's not hyperspace engineering."
"Pity."
Jaina considered wiping the scowl off the big silent guy's face, but decided it was impolitic.
"I could handle that."
Bevine walked toward the doors and jerked his head for her to follow. The man in gray ambled along beside him.
"We'll try to give you an alter ego," Bevine said. "A nasty Jaina. A crafty, cheating Jaina. A bounty-hunting Jaina. You up for that, Medica?"
"I'm all for giving folks a second career option," he said.
He was very well-spoken. Surprisingly so, as if he was a highly educated man. Jaina had expected him to be an inarticulate brute.
"But she can service the tiller droids first. Can't we send her back and get an Agricor Jedi instead?"
Bevin laughed.
Ingrate?
Fett had vanished. Jaina wondered what he got up to in his private hours, and when Bevin pointed out the hovel Fett was staying in, she was genuinely shocked. He could have had a palace. Bevin's farmhouse, with its shanty town of outbuildings and moat-like boundaries, reminded her more of a bastion than a haven of rural peace. The tunnels and passages seemed to run everywhere. Nothing was quite as it seemed. She stood in the grimy workshop with her arms in the oily guts of a tiller droid, listening to the whine and roar of vessels overhead. Fighters, definitely, the way the falling note indicated something moving away from her at high speed. While she adjusted clearances and checked filters, a small girl, 5, not a day older, she was certain, appeared in the doorway to stare at her. She wore a tiny version of the flight suit every Mandalorian had, with scaled-down but loose-fitting plates that looked a couple of sizes too big, and a holdout blaster hanging from the belt that looked full-size on her. The blaster was real.
"Hi, kid,"
Jaina smiled, ready to deflect a bolt.
"Sukui, J.T. Is that your blaster? Mama gave it to me."
The girl unholstered it like a professional, checked the safety catch, and held it with the muzzle pointing safely away from Jaina.
"I'm 5½. I'm training." "You and me both, sweetheart."
Jaina swallowed hard, more touched than worried.
"You and me both."
No. Mandalorians weren't what she'd expected at all. And she would learn to be as much of a surprise to her brother as they were to her.
"Thanks, Fett."
Imperial Palace, City of Ravelin, Bastion, 2 days later.
"Show the young lady in, Vitor."
Receiving visitors in the palace drawing room always reminded them what they were dealing with, Pelion thought. It was an imposing chamber that whispered casual wealth. It hinted that the Empire didn't have to try too hard. While he never let himself think of having an emperor's role, that way lay delusion and moral corruption, he was sure. He was in command, and he liked visitors to know that.
"And will it be Caff or Muritizan, sir?"
"Both, please."
Pelion could see a patch of vivid turquoise sky from the floor-to-ceiling windows, a little promise of escape in an otherwise stormy day. He missed being out with the fleet.
"And monitor the meeting, will you?"
"Of course."
Pelion saw no reason not to listen to what Jason Solo's envoy had to say. Listening committed him to nothing. It simply filled in the gaps, if his informants had actually left any. In a career spanning more than 70 years, he had built up a personal network that could give any state intelligence corps a run for its money. Even the apparently omnipotent Jason couldn't do much without leaving traces. He had to work with the raw stuff of society, troops, civil servants, clerks, even droids. The ship of state could leave an awfully big wake if you knew where to look. Tahiri Vela glided into the room right on time. Her bright blonde hair and general artless demeanor made her look too young to be sent on a task like this, although the Yuuzhan Vong markings still visible on her forehead evoked unpleasant memories.
"Jason, if you send a pretty girl to sweet-talk me, don't break the spell by reminding me of the Vong."
Pelion stood and ushered her to her chair. The spell was definitely broken before she'd even had a chance to cast it.
"Is this your first visit to Bastion?"
he asked, pouring her a Muritizan that spread an amethyst pool of light on the white marble table.
"If it is, don't leave without seeing the Imperial Gardens."
"I'll make a note of that, Admiral."
"So,"
he settled down in his seat, making a point of being slow and old, looking like easy prey. We live in challenging times, but here in our little backwater, we've managed to avoid the war, and I'm wondering what could possibly make it worth our while stepping out into that fray.
You have a very small empire,
but it's perfectly formed.
Here's our view in the GA.
Tahiri leaned forward slightly, like an earnest student.
The longer the war goes on, the worse the prospects for all of us, not just those directly involved in the fighting. We want stability. What we have is not just a split between GA and Confederation, but also systems unaligned to either and fighting their own local disputes. Hit the most powerful systems working against the GA, and things will be over faster.
You realize, Pelion said, that I've been here before, and more than once. And wasn't the short, sharp shock supposed to bring Corellia into line?
Tahiri evidently hadn't been briefed to argue a wider case than the offer to be put on the table. She blinked a couple of times.
It would work if you added your fleet and troops to ours.
Now give me a more immediate benefit for expending Imperial citizens' lives on this gamble. And it is a gamble.
Pelion couldn't look too willing. Every word would be reported back. Recorded, he suspected, and Jason would look for a deeper motive if he didn't raise objections. He'd raised them over targeting Corellia, after all.
I have to make a good case to the Moffs beyond vague plans for peace and galactic harmony. Permacrete, not vapor.
The GA is prepared to offer you Borlias and Bilbringi.
What are the conditions?
That the Empire first sends vessels and troops to attack Fondor with the GA.
Ah, performance-related pay. Very wise. With what objective?
Tahiri's eye movements, the occasional wobble as she tried to process the words, showed she wasn't yet used to the military jargon.
To bring it back to the GA.
But the detail matters, my dear. Is Jason planning to take over the orbital yards, or destroy them? What about the planet itself? Does he simply want to force a surrender? Is he preparing to subdue it by occupation? Each objective requires very different resources.
Tahiri recovered well.
I think the strategy is something you need to discuss with the Joint Chiefs of State. I'm only here to make the initial offer.
A good point,
Pelion said. Jason was nothing if not consistent. He really was working through his shopping list of planets to batter into submission.
I'll put it to the Moffs. But it's you who really calls the shots here, isn't it? However much power a man has, it's impossible to keep it for any length of time, unless he has the support of most of those under him. I consult. Chew on that, Jason Solo.
If he was smart, Jason might take it as advice from an old man who'd seen other autocrats pulled down by their underlings over the decades. Either way, Jason needed the Empire. If Pelion had read him right, no, if Jason thought like Pelion, then he knew he didn't have the numbers now to quickly crush key targets in the Confederation. But a sudden injection of troops and hulls might well tip the balance. One battle could change the course of a war. The only problem was that you never knew which one until years after the ceasefire.
And if you do win, Jason, the war still won't be over for the Empire. What kind of a galactic regime do you really have in mind?
Thank you for the tisane, Tahiri said. We'll be in touch, I hope.
After she left, Pelion summoned Rige.
Vitor, call the Moffs. Let's see who jumps at this and how fast.
Rige consulted his datapad and began tapping messages into the office comlink system.
Well, most of them are on Bastion at the moment, so you'll have nearly a full house to debate this. Are you accepting the offer, sir?
Pelion nodded.
If or when Jason gets his backside kicked, then the GA might fall apart, and we'll be there to pick up the pieces. If we sit it out, we take our chances. But if we back him, then we at least get greater control over events, whether he succeeds or not in the long run.
You think he will fail?
He's now faced with occupying or subduing half the galaxy to put the GA back together again. And he can't keep that up forever, however successful he is as a commander. Unless he comes up with a convincing peace deal that somehow bypasses the principle of a pooled GA defense force, then I don't see this ending. That's why the war started, remember?
Pelion waited for the Moffs to gather in the meeting room and tried to think like Jason. The man wasn't a fool, but could he see the galaxy through Fondorian eyes? Did he know which battle he was trying to win? He seemed to see worlds as controlled by a few stubborn leaders whose removal would free the population to see things his way. He didn't see that the general population didn't want to do things the GA way either. If you wanted to build an empire, well, the trick was to leave the population to get on with their lives. Pelion got up and walked across to the cabinet that housed hundreds of datapads, antique-bound flimsy, and even ancient animal-skin scrolls, military histories from a thousand worlds spanning millennia. He knew that if he picked one at random, any history at all, he would find much the same story as the one he was living through today. Seizure of power, the desire for expansion, and the inevitable inability to hold all that had been grabbed. The only variable was how long it took to fall apart. The longest-lived empires were those with the lightest hand on the reins.
"Empire can be different," he muttered aloud, "provided we shoot all the lunatics who enjoy the idea."
Where that left him, no. He was purged of ambition at 92. He simply wanted to leave the galaxy tidy and clean when he left it for the last time. That was what government was about, and the military was its instrument to achieve it. The Moffs, predictably, were mostly split between enthusiasm for the Jason Solo plan, ill-defined as it was, and those like Rosset who wanted to know more before signing up.
"I'm with you on this, Admiral," said Rosset, sitting opposite him across the mirror-polished table. "Putting orbital yards out of action is a very different proposition from subduing the planet itself. Are we going to end up policing Fondor for Jason Solo until Mustafar freezes over?"
Pelion was fascinated to note how Admiral Neothel had been erased from the scene. It was seen as Jason's war. The Mon Cal schemer would probably be happy about that, he thought. She could step in when Jason hit the buffers, hands relatively clean.
"How badly do we want Bill Bringy? Borlias?"
"They're not going to be costly to take," said Kiel. "Very small population on Borlias post Yuuzhan Vong. Probably happier to have someone like us look after them than not. Bill Bringy might require some military effort, though."
Like I mentioned before, Rosset said, we could take both systems if we wanted to without committing anything to the GA, because I don't think Jason's in a position to stop us.
Kiel had an expression of almost religious epiphany on his face. But the GA isn't going to be able to hold Fondor without us, because that'll require an occupying army after it surrenders. Poor old GA, short of hands, and we offer to look after the place while it's busy hammering more wayward systems back into the Alliance fold. We end up staying, and possession is 9/10 of the law, after all. Rosset let out a long breath.
I think they'll notice we tried to steal Fondor from under their noses.
I don't think they'll see it like that, Pelion interrupted. He was wary about agreeing with Kiel, even about the time of day. But the Moth had a point. And if Jason was going to fall sooner or later anyway, when he stretched himself just that little bit too far...
If we have both Borlias and Bilbringi, then that gives us a platform from which to maintain a presence on Fondor. And then we'll have expanded down past the core again.
Pelion didn't have to elaborate on that at all. Every Moth understood the potential.
Are we all agreed, then, gentlemen? We accept the GA's invitation, subject to their sharing the Fondor plan with us and our being able to resource our role?
Normal practice was to go around the table and record votes for and against, but the Moths paused in silence for a moment, and then all burst into spontaneous applause. Pelion wasn't sure if they were applauding him, or simply overwhelmed with martial emotion at the prospect of being back in the saddle.
"You are not entirely happy about this, are you, Admiral?"
Rige said as he made Pelion's nightcap, a mix of two parts Corellian brandy to one part water.
"You've never appeased the Moths before, and Jason Solo is..."
"Anathema to me? Yes. And I'm not appeasing the Moths now."
Pelion stood on the balcony of his chambers, looking out over the parkland beneath. The Imperial Cavalry's ceremonial troop was exercising the Bloodfins, cantering in a neat line along the rise and skylined for a moment against the sunset that passed for evening at this time of year on Bastion. For a few weeks the sun didn't set fully, and night never moved beyond a glowing dusk. It was a fine moment to sip a brandy and savor the fresh scent of cut grass on the breeze.
"I'm trying to make the best of a situation that Jason Solo will impose on the galaxy, whether we join him or not. If we don't, all the recovery effort after the last war will be for nothing. I anticipate that he will go the way of most despots and fall, or even hang. If that happens, when that happens, we shall be there to pick up the pieces. I have no faith in the GA to run anything beyond their Coruscant front garden, let alone a galaxy."
Pelion rolled the brandy glass slowly between his palms and glanced back at Rige. He really did look like his dead son Minar sometimes, and it would have been so simple to check, to test, to know for sure if Rige were his flesh and blood or not. No, it wouldn't have made any difference to Pelion's regard for him. He settled for never knowing. Some things were best left unknown.
"Anything else, sir?"
"Thank you, Vitor. No."
Pelion gestured with his glass.
"Care to join me?"
"Perhaps later, sir. I have some work to finish."
"I look forward to it."
Pelion stood at the window until he'd drained his glass, but neither the decision nor the brandy could make one thought go away. that Jason Solo was a self-serving megalomaniac, and there was nothing to reassure Pelion that the man would honor any agreement unless forced to. For all the victories he'd achieved, he was erratic, and the GA was still losing allies, even Hapes. And Kashyyyk, that was a disgrace to anyone in uniform. It was time to take out some insurance. Whatever Jason was planning for Fondor and the Empire, and Pelion was certain there was a whole side of the strategy that the Empire would not have been told, Pelion needed a trump card of his own.
And not one for the Moffs to see yet, either. We have our own Jasons here, too. Well, then, old friend, he said aloud.
He walked over to the floor-length mirror and smoothed back his white hair, checking the cut of his jacket.
Time to call in a favor.
He felt suddenly foolish. She wouldn't even see him. He was simply going to send a message, and one without a single word in it. But she would receive it, and she would know what it meant, and that it was critical. And she would respond. Pelion took out a few small flimsy card trinket boxes from his desk drawer and tapped his fingertips on the lid of each in turn, listening for the best approximation of a small drum. Rap, rap, rap. Rap, rap. Brr, rap. That was the one. Pelion settled down at the desk and positioned his comlink next to the box, ready to drum out his message. He had to rehearse it a few times. His fingers were a little stiff, but he refused to bow to arthritis even now. And Jason Solo had nothing on that.
I wouldn't do this unless I had to, my dear,
he said, and opened the comlink. Rap, 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 brr-rap. It was time for the warrior sailor Darakare to be summoned, as in the Irmenu legend. Pelion felt that the galaxy was slipping toward its darkest peril, and Jason might have looked like an ally, but Pelion knew he was truly a foe in every sense. Rap, 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 brr-rap. Darakare, long dead, probably didn't have the kind of firepower that Pelion wanted, even if he rose from his grave and answered the call. But the Admiral knew someone who did, and who had been very taken with the saga of the Irmenu hero. Rap, 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 brr-rap. The drum beat went out across space. It was just a repeating rhythm that would mean nothing to anyone except an Irmenu historian, if any could listen in on this secure link, and a warrior sailor who was, he hoped, still very much alive. Rap, 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 brr-rap. Pelion closed the link and settled in for a long wait.